Or do you think everyone should just...
Everyone should pivot at all times, no matter what the circumstances.
From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashok Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. My guest for this episode is Aaron Levy, founder and CEO of Box. Today we have a special two-part interview. In the first part, Aaron and I talk about how he founded the company in his early 20s, some of the struggles he faced while fundraising, and how he successfully navigated the transition from a consumer to an enterprise company. Well, Aaron, thank you for joining us today. Well, tell us a little bit about the founding story.
We started Box in 2004. And back in 2004, as you'll recall, it was just incredibly hard and annoying to share files.
Absolutely.
And so we were in college at the time, and we were sophomores in college, and we would be moving between different computers, a library computer, a dorm computer, a classroom computer, and you had to have a USB thumb drive, you had to email yourself files, you had to have external disk drive. And so we said, okay, this makes no sense. Like, why wouldn't you be able to just put these on the internet securely, store them centrally, and then access them from anywhere? It was one of those sort of once-in-a-decade opportunities where a bunch of things aligned within like a 12-month period that were fantastically serendipitous. You had Firefox had just launched, so you could have rich applications delivered over the internet. The cost of storage was dropping, you know, in a pretty rapid fashion. Internet bandwidth was getting way faster and sort of coming into our homes and workplaces, fiber, et cetera. So internet was faster, storage was cheaper, browsers were more dynamic and rich, and then also BlackBerries were starting to emerge. And so we kind of said, wait a second, like all these factors coming in at once means the way we're going to want to access our information is going to be completely different. We're going to work from anywhere. We're going to be able to share with anyone. So we hacked together this kind of prototype and we put it out on the internet, and then it was initially called Box.net, and people started signing up, and we were totally lucky because we had never launched anything that had worked.
Was this the first thing you had launched, or you had tried a bunch of ideas?
Probably about the 14th thing, but just like we got really, really good at launching things and then nobody showing up and then shutting it down. So like I had perfected the art of shutting down my startups, but not actually like having to like, you know, have users or whatever. And so it was amazing because like you get this the first couple like support emails where people were like you know, ran into a bug or they had a problem, and I was like so happy. I was like, holy
shit, there's
a person out there that is annoyed. Like this is amazing. Like we've made it. Like people actually are using the software and they don't like it or they do like it. And like it was so gratifying because we had done a lot of things that basically just nobody cared about. So we got a lot of feedback. We started to build more features, you know, make it faster, make it easier. And then the summer of 2005, decided to go out and raise some financing. My co-founder had funded most of the company at that point. He had done really well in online poker. So he had given $15,000, basically
gambling
invested.
Gambling paid for the company.
Gambling paid for the company. And so he invested $15,000 in the company, all of his like life savings from poker. And we were in Seattle trying to raise venture capital. It didn't really work very well. We got a couple angel investors.
So what did VC say when you...
A bunch of things. You know, one of the awkward things was, so we were 19 and 20, but my co-founder, our CFO, looked like he was 11. So I think the first thing that they probably thought was like, how did the middle school like bus drop these kids off, you know, in our neighborhood? So I think it was more just initially shock that like we were actually in college and that age. So, but I think Seattle was still sort of reeling from some of the dot-com bust. And so most investors, I think, was sort of savvy that there was this sort of Web 2.0 thing happening and that there was going to be another era of internet again. And so we mostly just got rejected on the basis of, you know, this is going to be too hard to compete. Is this whole sort of cloud thing real? It wasn't called cloud at the time. Obviously, it was just like, would people really trust the internet with their data? And all of the feedback was totally totally both accurate and rational. But unless you knew for a fact, like there was going to be 4 billion people on the internet and the world was going to move to the cloud, In which case, then you
it
know,
was rational but wrong.
It was rational but wrong. And so we got lucky. You had to find irrational people.
Who was the first investor?
So we had a couple of small angel investors, but the first real investor was Mark Cuban. And so you have to have somebody with his level of both. Yeah, obviously, kind of.
And how did you find Mark? I mean.
Well, his email,
we were 19 and 20,
his
so.
Email address was very much visible on the internet, and we shot him an email and said, "Hey, Mark, dear sir, we have an internet website we'd love you to look at," and he took a look at it, and
he took the call. Wow.
He took the email, and then ultimately we corresponded, and he was interested enough to invest in the company. So, which was pretty cool because while I wasn't personally a basketball fan. I was when we went back to college, our junior year. I was living with my friends were very very big basketball fans, and we got this check for $350,000, and I was like, wait a second, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks just sent you $300,000. What kind of operation are you running here? What's going on? And that I think compelled us to basically say, okay, maybe there's a bigger idea here than we realize. Like if a billionaire is going to invest in us and bet on the company, maybe we need to like take this way more seriously. So we decided, okay, let's actually really focus on the business. So we dropped out of college, moved up to the Bay Area, first to Berkeley, and then a couple other friends dropped out of college, and then the four of us sort of were living and working together, just trying to build this company.
So you've raised $300,000. Yep. You've moved across the coast. You're getting users, and you started off as a consumer company.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the shift from being a consumer company to an enterprise company.
Yeah, so we were initially four of us, and then five and six and so on. We raised a Series A from Josh Stein from DFJ, now Threshold, and he basically had identified that there was some magic here. Didn't quite understand. I don't think anybody really understood what it was, but users were signing up. They were paying money for it, and he sort of saw that there was this moment where maybe if everybody moved to the internet and they moved their data to the internet, you could charge a bunch of people, and it could be a real business. So he bet on us, the first venture capital, and Emily Melton from Threshold and kind of discovered us at DFJ. We went in, we pitched, we said, okay, we think that everyone's data is going to be on the internet. We'll charge people a few bucks a month. It was very much a consumer kind of oriented model.
And I was an early user, I remember.
Okay, well, thank you. Did you pay us?
I don't think so.
Okay, that's why we had to pivot, actually. So basically what happened was we looked at our user base and we sort of said, okay, well, 2% of people are paying or 3% of people are paying. And you just sort of did the math and you're just like, well, man, how long is it going to take you to build a real business here when you only have 2, 3, 4% of people paying? And we kind of got to this struggle, which is, okay, you either had to be a consumer product that really optimized for everything that you would optimize for a consumer product, like upsell percentage and consumer use cases, all of that, or we were listening to customers and we heard all these more advanced and more significant business use cases. And those were things like, I want better security, I want to be able to run business process on Box, I want to be able to share files across my enterprise. And that was an entirely different segment of the market, but with the same foundation of make it really easy to share information and power how businesses work. And so we basically said, okay, we think there's actually a bigger opportunity in the enterprise space. We looked at the market and it was mostly made up of these large incumbents that were selling on-premises infrastructure or on-premises software. And while we didn't really know it at the time, when we had started the company, we actually were totally serendipitously a low-end disruptor in the very classic innovator's dilemma sense to traditional enterprise content management software and technology.
Things like SharePoint.
Yes, and simpler, faster, cheaper, better, more open. And so we didn't know that at the time when we were building the company, but ultimately it sort of followed the perfect kind of law of disruptive innovation, which is the incumbents were making things more complicated, more expensive, harder to use over time to only solve the more advanced problems. We had come in with this very simple end user democratized consumerized tool, but for the enterprise. And so we basically pivoted the company and we said, holy shit, we have this massive opportunity to basically disrupt all of how enterprises.
But culturally, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, you have a company that's set up around how many people were you when you made the pivot?
Well, it wasn't. That's why it's always tough because it's sort of like it was a burn the bridges moment for the business. but it was a business of 15 to 20 people. And so it was
sort
of
like... early enough.
Yeah, it was early enough. It was like our all hands was like, okay, let's get around a lunch table and have a conversation. So it didn't feel at the time like as dramatic as you'd want. It was not like this Braveheart kind of moment for the company. It was much more like, hey, like, I don't think our business model is going to work. We're going to have to change our business model. We're going to go after enterprises now. And we wrote up a PowerPoint presentation and you know, had a whole memo. But ultimately, kind of just changed the business and said, okay, we're going to go after enterprises. But the key was, and where it was hard was, this, you had to kind of prevent the antibodies of like your own, you know, kind of like orientation of preventing you from doing the enterprise thing. So you had to say, okay, like, so how do we take all of the stuff we had as our core DNA, and how do we make sure that we use that as an advantage as we go into the enterprise? Yeah.
So I want to sort of interrupt for a second and talk a little bit about the decision itself.
Yeah.
Because this is a hard decision for a lot of founders. I mean, just yesterday I was sitting with one of my portfolio companies. This was the conversation with the CEO. You know, I'm getting a conversion rate. It's 5-7%. I'm charging $10 a month. I have one enterprise willing to pay me $50K.
Yeah, pivot.
Where should I focus?
They should pivot. Yeah, for sure.
What question should they ask? Do you think everyone should just...
Pivot at all times, no matter what the circumstances. I think that it depends on a whole bunch of factors, obviously. And every single... This is definitely one of the categories where you can't give generalized advice. You can only do it on a case-by-case basis because every company is different. I think you have to look at things like, okay, what's the theoretical addressable market? If you built a category for what you were doing, and that category was as wildly successful as it could be, what is that addressable market if you had different levels of conversion rate on a more self-service end user, you know, driven model? And what is that addressable market if you charge enterprises the max that they would be willing to pay? And as you kind of play that out, to the extent that you actually can predict that and have some degree of foresight and accuracy, that's part of the way to basically discover kind of what kind of business are you really in. In our case, we sort of played out and we said, well, at a billion consumers, if you only can get a couple percentage to pay, and like we were at law of large numbers at the million users we had at the time, so you kind of know the rough percentage. If you can only get a couple percentage of people to pay at a billion users, the math doesn't add up. And so versus if you said, well, what if enterprises were willing to pay $1 million or $2 million or $5 million for this software because it was so powerful that it changed how they ran their business, and you had...
You needed hundreds of them.
And you needed hundreds or thousands, and then you could even for the long tail, make a business off of $50,000 in enterprise or $100,000 in enterprise, and then it became pretty obvious. But very different products have different kinds of equations.
Got it.
For that.
Got it. So now you've made the decision to shift to the enterprise. You still have DFJ as your original investor.
Yep.
You now have to go back and raise more money.
Yep.
What was that experience like?
That was tough, and we got saved, but that one was really tough. So we were raising a Series B in the midst of a pivot. We had fantastic support from Josh Stein, but you still had to go raise your next round. We were running out of capital. We needed to fund the business. I would say absolutely the least enjoyable experience is trying to pitch VCs while you're pivoting the company, because basically they're kind of saying, well, most of your revenue today looks like a very different kind of revenue. You're telling me that there's a new opportunity here, but you have no evidence of that other than like 5% of your revenue looks like that new type. And it really takes an extreme amount of conviction on behalf of the VC to go along with that. And so we got turned down by almost everybody in Silicon Valley. And the one investor that didn't turn us down, it ultimately invested in us, was Mamoun Hamid. At the time was at USVP. And I think it worked out really well because he was very early in his investment career.
It made his career.
We'll take credit for anything. So why not? But it was.
But let's talk a little bit about the people who turned you down.
Yeah.
You know, what was your least favorite meeting?
My least favorite meeting. I'm not gonna.
Without naming the person.
I'd love to, but
no.
I would say I don't fault or argue with anybody for not investing in us, because I, you know, realistically, I don't think I would have invested in us now knowing what I know and how hard this is. But we got turned down for every version. So call us when you have more traction. You will never compete with Microsoft. You will never compete with EMC. Google's going to give this away for free. So it was a mix of basically people completely not understanding the market, like Google will give this away for free, is misunderstanding enterprise software just definitionally. You can't compete with Microsoft was a very valid argument, but we felt like we had more of a disruptive mechanism that people weren't appreciating. And so we got every version of this. I think, you know, it probably didn't help again that at the time, maybe the founding team was 23 and 22. And so it was like, can this group really build an enterprise software company? Like, I had never bought a suit in my life. I was taking meetings in hoodies, thinking that that was the cool thing to do. It wasn't like the obvious enterprise software, like, oh, these people grew up at Oracle, and like, we're just going to bet that they can go.
It wasn't like Benioff starting.
It wasn't like Benioff. And even Benioff, though, in Behind the Cloud, will tell you that like he got turned down. Because people didn't think SaaS was going to work. So if Benioff couldn't fucking raise the money, we certainly couldn't. So everybody turned us down, got lucky with Mamoun, because I think Mamoun was he had not been burned by this kind of model not working. He had not had the enterprise software play that didn't work, that Microsoft crushed. And so you almost needed that level of
naivety.
And so he bet on us, and we got super lucky.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for other founders who are in the same situation you are? You know, they're young, they're early in their careers, they've never raised money before, they've never worn a suit, and they're getting turned down by 10, 15 VCs. What would you say to them?
I'll give you the, I mean, again, it's all case by case, but in general, in our situation, here's how we felt at the time, the thing that kept us going, and I want another kind of shout out in that process. I raised the round, a lot of the time that we spent raising the B round was with Karen Appleton, our first head of business development. And she would, we'd go to a VC and we'd pitch the business, and then, you know, you could just tell at the end of the meeting, it would be like, you know, oh yeah, we'll get back to you in a couple of days. Let us talk to partners. And that's not how you want a meeting to end. You want it to end like next steps, and like, we're ready to rock. And like, this is the most exciting thing. Like, that was very much basically them saying that within the first 12 minutes, they knew this wasn't happening. We'd like go after a meeting to McDonald's or whatever. She would drive me to McDonald's, and we'd be like crying in the car. But the thing that kept us going was this conviction that while we don't know for a fact we can win, or that we're going to be the ones that can deliver on this, we know for a fact that this is the future.
It's going to happen.
And it's going to happen. And so if you don't let we never let any feedback sort of like impact the fact that we knew this was the future of where the world was going. And so, yes, like, people don't think that we're going to be the ones that can deliver this. Let's optimize our pitch. Let's optimize our business model. Let's optimize our story. Let's figure out what people are missing. But we knew for a fact this was the future. And I think you have to have that kind of conviction that basically no one could possibly tell you otherwise that what you believe in is going to be true. And sometimes founders are wrong, and they go after industries that don't end up playing out. But like, you have to believe deep down inside that this is the future. And then it's just honestly just optimizing the story, the strategy, the business model, who you're pitching, how you're pitching them. And we kept doing that. We postmortemed every pitch, and we were like, what do we have to change? Why is this part of the story getting a bad reaction? Maybe we should tell, you know, the story in this way. And we kept optimizing, and then eventually, you know, landed an investment. But like, if Mamoun hadn't invested, we would have found the next 20 investors, yeah. Probably not in Sand Hill Road, because I think
you would have made it work.
At that point, we I think Sand Hill Road had you know, got the note that don't take meetings from Box employees. I think Mamoun maybe had missed that memo.
Very cool. Very cool. We'll be right back.
If Albert Einstein had worked in human resources instead of quantum physics, he would have said that hiring is hard. Not as hard as the general theory of relativity, but way harder than the special theory of relativity. I mean, come on. It would have been obvious to an HR professional as brilliant as Einstein that getting the best people is the difference between being a great company and a mediocre one. That's why Einstein would have loved Eightfold. Eightfold is the most effective way for companies to identify promising candidates, engage talent, reach diversity goals, and retain top performers. Businesses using Eightfold's talent intelligence platform have been able to achieve 7 times higher candidate responses, 80% faster hiring cycles, and 60% lower cost to hire. That's why Eightfold would have been Einstein's favorite talent management tool, and that's why it should be yours too. Eightfold improves hiring. Visit eightfold.ai to learn more.
Can you talk a little bit, independent of fundraising, what were the one or two other lessons or mistakes that, you know, you look back and say, shit, what was I thinking?
I mean, so many things. I mean, we got so many things about our business model or that early on. I mean, the fundamentals were all correct, which is like, let's use end users to spread in an enterprise, sell to the larger customer, and then that will be the business model. But I think we thought probably the whole thing was going to be an inside sales model. We were like, okay, the future of all software sales is inside sales because you can do everything over the web and it can all be in a call, you know, in some kind of like office call center. And we were like, we were just very naive because like I had not met that many Fortune 500 CIOs at that point to realize that they're not going to talk to your inside sales rep. That's just not how it works. Like they have to have a meeting with a bunch of executives, they have to shake your hand, and that's the only way that they're going to buy software.
I'm laughing because I had this conversation yesterday with one of these.
He's
convinced he can sell his software on the phone.
Yeah. Well, and again, there are a couple exceptions.
Yeah.
There are a couple exceptions. If you have a developer tool, for instance, that is very self-service, end-user driven, that might be the one audience where I think you could maybe get away with it. You look at an Atlassian model and it's working. But basically, if you're selling to business people, if your sale requires any sort of senior executive, you're not going to be on the phone. You're not going to be doing that in a self-service way. And I think that was especially as 20-year-old founders, sort of just imagine like, well, how would we want to buy technology? And like, we want to get rid of all of the friction from everything. We don't want to talk to the phone. We don't want to do anything. We just want, tell us the price, we'll buy online, and we're done. And it's like, unfortunately, this podcast will be the awakening for some people, but the real world doesn't work like that way. The real world has hierarchy and bureaucracy and budgets and budget review cycles and budget review processes and councils and committees, and your website can't solve that. So it's really unfortunate. I wish we could change everything about the world, but that's not happening.
What else?
So that's a big one. I think, one thing I'm going to give you the opposite. One thing that was really good that we held on to was our conviction on the product, where we basically said, we are so convinced that the future is in the cloud and that you can get better security in the cloud, you can get better privacy in the cloud, you can get better compliance in the cloud, and we're not going to let customers bifurcate the software, run it on-prem, and then not get all of the advantages that we build into the technology.
And which was not obvious at the time. I'm sure a lot of people said we want an on-prem version, et cetera, et cetera.
In this area, I cannot exaggerate how not obvious it was. We lost so much business from customers that said, I cannot buy you unless you put this thing on-prem. And now, I'll tell you the end result of that is actually really good news. But we lost a tremendous amount of material revenue from 2007 to 2012, where if all we had was an on-prem version of our software, we would have gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, but we would have totally screwed up our architecture in a way that would be impossible to ever mitigate and kind of recover from. Now the good news is, because of that conviction, because of the architectural approaches that we had early on, 10 years later, in 2019, we are now talking to the same customers that said NFW on buying your cloud version. Today, we're talking to them because they've seen the light, because, again, of our conviction about where the market had to go, just inevitably, they are now some of our biggest customers. And it's not that they were wrong, it's just the market was too early. We hadn't gone through the motions. And so because of that conviction, though, they're now benefiting from a much better platform, a much more scalable platform that is ultimately much more durable and, you know, way better technology for them.
That's it for the first part of my conversation with Aaron Levy. Come back in a couple of weeks and you can hear me talking to Aaron about hiring, building a great culture, and growing up and becoming a public company. That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Arshu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you're interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.